in the reflection of a waiter's large silver tray, polished and gleaming. It showed for 2.7 seconds, three guests at a private corner table in the gallery lounge. The head of GHS Engineering sat with two male companions, Stephen Horowitz and Alexander Plessner. Back and forth Zhongyi went, over and over the footage, until he was certain that he recognized one of the men at the table. Just hours before the attacks, Claude Dussault, the prefect of police, was having tea with Eugenie Roquebrune. Beauvoir got to his feet. It was almost 10:30. He could call, but Dussault was at the Gamaches. He didn't want to say anything that might be overheard. A man naturally given to action, Zhongyi had come late to the value of pausing. "It is solved by walking," Gamache had often said. In the middle of a stressful case, the chief would leave his office, and instead of doing something, he'd go for a walk, often just up and down the corridors of Sûreté headquarters, hands clasped behind his back, occasionally muttering, while Beauvoir, figuratively, danced tigger-like around him. Gamache had patiently explained, over and over, over the years, that he was doing something. He was thinking. It had taken Beauvoir years to see the power of pausing, and of patience, of taking a breath to consider all options, all angles, and not simply acting on the most obvious. After looking in on Annie and Honoré, he put on a light jacket and went out for a walk. Chapter 24. When the men returned to the living room with dessert and coffee, Raine-Marie nodded toward the box. "Find anything interesting?"
"Look at this," said Armand, "and tell us what you think."
He handed them the GHS annual report, open to the page listing the board of directors.
"My God, the former president of France?" said Monique. "An ex-American secretary of state?"
"Look, a Nobel laureate," said Raine-Marie. "I read her book. Formidable."
They scanned the list of diplomats, world leaders, philosophers, and artists.
"Anything strike you?" asked Armand.
"Beside the caliber of members," said Monique, "GHS must be incredibly powerful to attract such people."
"Yes," said Armand.
He was watching Raine-Marie as she stared at the list. Then, after taking a large forkful of creamy cake, she turned to the president's report. There was a photo of the CEO, Eugenie Roquebrune, and below it a précis of their corporate philosophy.
"Seems interesting to me," she said slowly. "Who's not on the board?"
"What do you mean?"
Monique re-examined the names.
"This is an engineering firm, right?" said Raine-Marie. "So why aren't there any engineers?"
"There are no scientists of any kind. Nobel laureates, but not in economics or physics. They're in literature.
And why aren't there any accountants? Anyone who could read a financial statement and see if there's anything wrong? They're all politicians and diplomats, minor royalty and celebrities. There's this one fellow, head of a media empire, but that doesn't mean he can read a spreadsheet even if he wanted to."
And that, thought Armand, was the crux. How much did these people actually want to know?
"Not exactly the checks and balances you'd hope for in a board of directors," said Monique.
The photo of Madame Roquebrune smiled out at them. She seemed pleasant enough, but did not give the impression of immense power or even authority. But then that might have been the idea. Gamache suspected nothing. No word, no image, not even the font, was chosen without intense scrutiny. Raine-Marie also studied the photograph. She saw a woman in her early 50s, elegant, warm, kindly even, not at all intimidating or formidable. In fact, as she looked closer, Raine-Marie saw there was a very small eyelash on Madame Roquebrune's cheek. It was almost unnoticeable, except as a tiny human flaw. It was actually quite endearing. She wanted to brush it away. And that, Raine-Marie knew, was the trap, even as she felt herself drawn into it. Could this, she found herself wondering, really be one of the most powerful people in France, in Europe? But then her own husband was often mistaken for a college professor, not a man who hunted killers. The GHS president was not kindly and benign, and its board was not oversight. It was a facade, a stamp of legitimacy. The men and women on the board gave the corporation access and cover should anything go wrong.
Claude, do you know this Eugénie Roquebrune?
Armand asked.
No, he said, though that's some impressive board. I wonder if Monsieur Horowitz really did have anything on GHS. Hard to believe people like that could be taken in.
People believe what they want to believe, said Renmarie. It's just human nature.
Reminds me of the story of the oil man who went to heaven, said Claude. He shows up at the pearly gates, and St. Peter says, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is, you've got into heaven. Fantastic, says the oil man, but what's the bad news? I'm afraid the part of heaven reserved for oil men is full. Well, I know how to solve that, says the oil man. Take me to them. When St. Peter does, the oil man calls for their attention and announces, exciting news, they've struck oil in hell. And with that, the place empties out. St. Peter turns to the oil man and says, that was amazing, you can go in now. Are you kidding? Says the oil man. I'm going to hell. I hear they struck oil there.
The other three laughed.
It's true what you say, Remarie, said Claude. People believe what they want to believe, beginning with their own lies.
Hell is the truth seen too late, said Renmarie, as she poured out more coffee. Thomas Hobbes.
For a moment, Armand could feel Stephen's steely grip on his wrist and see his laser-blue eyes staring at him as they sat in the garden of the Musée Rodin, in front of the gates of hell.
I've always told the truth, Armand.
Jean-Guy glanced around to see if he could spot anyone watching, but he was alone in the park. He walked along the path, unconsciously clasping his hands behind his back. As he strolled, Jean-Guy Beauvoir went over what he'd found and what it could mean, and, equally disturbing, what Annie had told him and what that could mean. Jean-Guy stopped, supposedly to stare into the duck pond, but actually he'd picked up the fact he wasn't alone. Someone was quietly watching from the shadows. A thief? Was he about to be robbed?
It is a mystery, he hummed as he slowly circled the pond. It is a big mystery.
Then, turning quickly, his hand shot out, but the man had lightning reflexes and jumped out of his grasp, then turned and took off. Jean-Guy ran after him, and while the man was younger and had the advantage of age, Jean-Guy had the advantage of rage. The man ran out into the traffic along Rue de Bretagne. Horns sounded and curses followed them down Rue du Temple, the distance between the men growing. The man turned down an alley, knocking over bins to slow his pursuer. While all his survival instincts, all his training, told Jean-Guy it was a mistake to follow a suspect into a dark alley, his instincts as a husband and father were stronger. The man disappeared around a corner. Skidding around the corner, Beauvoir saw a brick wall at least 10 feet high blocking their way. It was a dead end. The man didn't slow down, didn't hesitate. He ran full tilt at it, leaping and grabbing the top. Pulling himself up, he went over the other side. At the very top, he twisted and looked back, directly at Beauvoir. Then he dropped from sight. Beauvoir got to the wall and jumped, clutching for the top, his fingers scraping the bricks, clawing at them for purchase. But he skidded down, once, twice, 3 times he tried, then stopped, bending over, holding his knees, gasping for breath.
Fuck, fuck, fuck,
he muttered, pounding the wall with each word. Then he turned and jogged back to the apartment, picking up speed, breaking into a run as his mind raced ahead of him. Had he actually been lured away? Was he meant to chase one man while another broke in? He was running across streets as cars slammed on brakes. At his building, he took the stairs 2 at a time, yanking himself up with the handrail. The door to their apartment was closed and still locked. But, hands trembling, he unlocked it and ran to Honoré's room, then checked on Annie. Both were asleep, both snoring lightly. Returning to the front door, he double-locked it. Then, leaning against it, he slid down, landing on the floor, his knees to his chin and his head in his hands. What could have happened to his family? He got up and walked unsteadily into the living room. The chase had not been totally futile. He'd found out one thing. The man had turned at the top of the wall on purpose, so that Jean-Guy could get a good look at him. It was the guard, Loisel. Jean-Guy's bloody hand reached for the phone. The chief was right. Some things were solved by walking, and some by running. Armand put down the phone and turned to Claude. Did you assign an agent to guard Annie?
I asked Irena to do it. Why?
Because, snapped Armand, there's no one there, except, as it turns out, a security guard working for GHS. They're watching the apartment.
Armand,
said Renmarie, standing up. They're all right. No thanks to you, he said to Dussault. Jean-Guy chased him away. Claude Dussault picked up his phone and made a call. A moment later, he hung up.
An agent has been assigned, but his shift won't start until midnight.
I'm sorry, I didn't make it clear to Fontaine that this was a priority. A flic is on his way now.
Armand continued to stare at the prefect, who coloured under the unrelenting glare.
Désolé, Dussault repeated.
Gamache was far from convinced this man was désolé. He was also concerned that any gendarme Dussault sent would be there not to guard, but to watch, and maybe do more, if it came to that. The Dussaults were on their feet, understanding that the evening was over. But as Claude bent to pick up the box, Armand stopped him.
I'd like to keep this for a day.
The two men locked eyes over the box, over the barricade, and the prefect, knowing he was in a difficult position after his failure earlier, conceded. But he wasn't surrendering completely.
I'll just take this, then.
He picked up the laptop. Had they actually been at the barricades, Armand had the impression Dussault would have pulled the trigger. And he'd have shot back.
Chapter 25. What was that about?
Monique asked as they got in their car.
The Horowitz case, said Claude, tossing the laptop into the back seat.
I know that, but there was tension. More than tension. Is something wrong?
No.
But her husband was distracted, enough to actually get lost for a moment in the narrow streets of the Marais.
I'll drop you at home. I need to speak with Irena.
At this hour? It's almost 11. Claude, what's going on?
Nothing. I need to get her the laptop, now that we have the password. I'll be home before midnight.
He dropped her at the door to their building and made sure she got in safely, then drove off. Monique walked up the stairs slowly, thinking. Her husband's scent, even more rank than she remembered it, clung to her clothing. Beauvoir opened the door. Once in, Renmarie hugged Jean-Guy.
You all right? Armand asked, noticing the scrapes on Jean-Guy's hand.
A bit shaken, to be honest. It really is different when it's your own family.
His eyes were wide.
Thank you for coming.
Annie? Asked Armand.
Asleep. So's Honoré.
Despite the reassurance, Renmarie and Armand walked to the bedrooms, peered in, then returned to the living room.
We brought this. Renmarie held up the pastry box. I'll make some tea.
They followed her into the small kitchen and put out the tea things.
What happened? Armand asked.
Jean-Guy described it, then said,
I'll tell you, Armand. That guy barely touched the wall as he went over. That's no ordinary guard. And I'm pretty sure he wanted me to recognize him.
Bit of psychological warfare, said Armand.
But the good news is, his orders were to follow me, not to do any harm to Annie or Honoré. There's something else. He works for Secure Fort.
The same company that has the contract with the Georges V, said Gamache, who almost certainly doctored the tapes.
It gets worse. SecureFort is owned by GHS.
Armand paused for a beat, taking that in. How do you know?
I found an old article in some American mercenary magazine. Let me show you.
They returned to the living room and took seats side by side on the sofa, in front of the laptop. Armand read, then looked up.
What are you thinking?
That GHS is using SecureFort to spy on other corporations.
And Stephen found out. It's possible.
Annie walked, waddled, into the room in her bathrobe.
What time is it? Is it morning? What's going on?
She looked at the clock on the mantel.
It's 11:30. Why are you here? Has something happened?
Her eyes landed on the cake.
Is that an Ispahan?
She seems to be giving birth to questions, said Jean-Guy.
Careful.
Annie placed a hand over her stomach.
You don't want the baby to join the conversation, do you?
Once they were all sitting down, Jean-Guy told her about the GHS guard. Annie turned white.
You chased him? Are you crazy? Are you all right?
She took his hand.
You're hurt.
No, no, I'm fine. They're just trying to scare us.
Are you sure?
She looked at her father, who'd been silent.
Daddy?
She only used that word when something awful had happened, or was happening. Just then there was a knock on the door. Jean-Guy went to it and returned a minute later.
It's the cop, come to guard us.
I've been thinking, Armand said, that maybe you need to move into Stephen's suite at the Georges V.
But will it be any safer?
Asked Rennemarie.
SecureFort's there, too. Mum's right, said Annie. They'll be all over the Georges V. Why would we be safer there?
Because you wouldn't be alone, said her father. There'll be other guests, staff, support.
You mean witnesses? I see your point.
Annie turned to Jean-Guy.
A few days in a luxury hotel? If we must.
Just don't order the caviar, dear, said Rennemarie, or toast, or anything.
I need to show you something on the security cameras, said Jean-Guy. Something they didn't erase. They huddled around his laptop while he showed them the clip, gone in the blink of an eye, of a woman arriving at the Georges V.
This was yesterday, late afternoon, he said.
It's the head of GHS, said Rennemarie. I recognize her from the annual report.
Eugénie Roquebrune was indeed recognizable. The only woman in the lobby, perhaps in the entire hotel, maybe in all of Paris, with grey hair.
Now, said Beauvoir, bringing up the next clip. This is half an hour later. Look at the reflection in the tray the waiter's holding.
They watched as the uniformed waiter put a teapot and a three-tiered tower of little sandwiches and petit four on a table. While he spoke to the guests, he lowered the large silver tray to his side so that it reflected the guests at another table. They watched it twice through before Armand hit pause.
It's Claude Dussault, he said, and sighed, staring at the screen. Meeting with the head of GHS. That's it, then.
His fear confirmed. Despite the tension that evening and Armand's growing discomfort with his old friend and colleague, he'd still held out hope that he'd gotten it wrong. But he could no longer hide from the truth. Having afternoon tea with the head of an engineering giant was hardly a crime, but he was the prefect of police for Paris, and GHS appeared up to its neck in this business. The business of murder. Attempted murder, and whatever it was Stephen had discovered. Besides, when asked directly if he knew the CEO, Claude Dussault had denied it. He'd looked Gamache in the eye and lied.
"Who's the other man?" asked Annie.
They could see the back of his head and a bit of his face as he turned to listen to Madame Roquebrune. Dark hair, close-cropped, clean-shaven.
"Madame Roquebrune's security?"
asked Rennemarie.
"I don't think so. A security guard wouldn't sit down for tea with a client," said Armand. "He's part of whatever meeting's happening."
"But what is happening?"
asked Reine-Marie.
I can't imagine the CEO herself is telling the prefect of police in a public place to go kill a man.
They obviously didn't know that Stephen was actually staying right there, said Jean-Guy. It was just a few flights above them.
Armor leaned closer to the image and remembered the grainy photo of Himmler in Bar Josephine. Terrible things were discussed by confident people in public places. And there was a reason this recording had been erased. When the killings and search were bungled, they had to kick over all trace. Innocent people holding innocent meetings didn't erase the evidence, as Securefort had done, and deny that it ever happened, as Claude had done.
What would they have to offer to get him to do it? Asked Reine-Marie.
He talked tonight about retirement, said Armand. They must have offered him more money than he could ever make as a cop. A lifetime of peace and security for himself and his family.
Armand rubbed his forehead, his fingers naturally finding the long, deep scar at his temple.
What would it take?
Said Reine-Marie. There's something you should know. I asked Monique, she turned to Annie and Jean-Guy and explained, Dr. Dussault, Claude's wife. I asked her tonight about his cologne. I'm sorry, Armand, but it seemed the only way.
That's all right, he said. I'm sure you were careful.
I think I was. I found out that it's called 4711. I have a bottle of it at home that I bought this afternoon at the BHV.
You found it? Said Armand.
Oui. I wanted to be able to confirm it really is the same scent we smelled, and that Claude really does use it. I didn't show Monique the bottle. I just said I was looking for a gift for you, Armand, she said, turning to face him directly. It is Claude's cologne. Monique confirmed it.
He gave a very small nod.
She told me his second-in-command bought some for him and for herself,
Reine-Marie continued,
when they were on a trip together in Cologne. They toured the place where it's made. Monique says Claude only puts it on when they're going to meet.
There was silence as they took that in.
That means, Reine-Marie said, deciding they were taking too long to get there, that it could have been Irena Fontaine we interrupted in Stephen's apartment.
It could also mean they're closer than we realized. We need to find out more about her, said Jean-Guy.
And Securefort, said Reine-Marie.
She took over the laptop and put the name in. Up came a website. It was Spartan, to say the least. All they could see was the home page. They needed a security code to access more. The homepage photo showed a handsome, well-groomed, muscular man in a suit, standing alert beside a Maybach, while a woman, smiling but also alert, held the door open for a little girl and her mother. In the bottom right-hand corner was their logo.
That's the same emblem I saw on the guard's uniform, said Jean-Guy. The same one in that article.
It looks like a snowflake, said Annie. Why would they have a snowflake as a corporate logo? Look closer, said Reine-Marie, doing just that. Those are spears, tridents, in a circle.
The spears were radiating out from the central point, as though protecting it.
That's no snowflake, said Reine-Marie. That's a promise and a warning.
Clever, she smiled, making it look like one thing while actually being something else, hiding its real nature. An insignia like that is more than just a corporate logo. It's a symbol. It means something. Most paramilitary emblems do. After a few dead ends, she sat back and turned the screen to the others.
Voila, the helm of awe. You're kidding, right? Said Annie, leaning in. Sounds like a comic book.
The Helm of Awe, Reine-Marie read, is an ancient Norse symbol of protection and overwhelming might.
What's the Sûreté du Québec logo again?
Jean-Guy asked as they stared at the Helm of Awe.
A kitten?
Playing with a ball of yarn, oui, said Armand.
Annie laughed. They all knew the Sûreté logo was a fleur-de-lis, a flower. Appropriate, but hardly awe-inspiring.
Fortunately, they didn't need a symbol to be inspired. Does it say who runs Securefort? Asked Armand.
No, said Reine-Marie, but I'm sure I can find out.
Actually, there's something else we need you to look into, said Armand.
He told her and Annie about the documents Irena Fontaine had produced, questioning which side Stephen was on in the war.
But that's ridiculous, said Annie. There's no way he was a Nazi.
Those documents were supposedly suppressed by the Allies, you say?
Said Renmarie.
Hidden in the Archives Nationales? I have experience with those archives. They're immense. If those documents were buried 75 years ago, they wouldn't be easy to find. And yet she had them within hours of the investigation beginning. That doesn't make sense.
Go on, said Armand.
Renmarie thought. They must have already had them, ready to use if necessary.
By they, you mean Fontaine's boss, the préfet de police, said Beauvoir. They were back to Claude Dussault. All leads led them there.
Looks like it, yes, said Armand.
But why?
Asked Annie.
Suppose Stephen found out that GHS was, for example, stealing corporate secrets, said her father. They'd have to stop him before he exposed them. How would they do that?
They could kill him, said Annie.
Yes, that would do it, but it's pretty drastic and risky. I think they'd try something else first.
Blackmail, said Jean-Guy. They went looking for some dirt to hold over him. Maybe something criminal.
They found those documents from the war, said Renmarie, and threatened to use them. If he exposed them, they'd tar him as a collaborator.
Jean-Guy nodded. He'd been in France long enough to know that the Second World War was never that far away, especially the tender issue of who worked for the resistance and who claimed to, but actually worked for the Nazis. He'd learned early on that he should never suggest collaborating with a colleague. It was an incendiary word.
Well, if that was the strategy, they don't know him, said Renmarie. That would just make him more determined than ever.
So they moved to Plan B. Armand turned to Renmarie. Is there a record of who asks for which files at the archives?
There is, and I can look it up.
She paused.
But I have to be there. There's something else, Armand. Something Annie found out.
I asked a colleague at my law firm to look into the work we did for Alexander Plessner, said Annie. He got back to me late this afternoon. Monsieur Plessner had an agreement drawn up to form a limited partnership here in France. This was earlier this year.
When Annie hesitated, Armand said, Go on.
The agreement was with a newly created department within the Banque Privée des Affaires, the Venture Capital Division.
Daniel?
Armand said, and saw Annie nod.
But maybe he didn't actually know Plessner.
He did. His name's on the incorporation certificate.
Daniel had lied.
Chapter 26. Armand stood up. I'm going over there.
You can't, said Renmarie. It's almost midnight.
Then he's sure to be in.
He was walking to the door.
Armand, stop!
It was a command from Renmarie.
And he did. But he remained with his back to her. Not for the moment wanting her to see the rage, the outrage he felt toward their son. The hurt.
He lied.
Yes, said Renmarie. But storming over there isn't going to help. You know that.
Now he did turn and held her eyes.
He lied. Not just to the police, but to us.
To me.
He was probably in shock when Commander Fontaine said it was Alexander Plessner who'd been killed, said Renmarie. You know, Daniel, he feels things deeply and takes his time to think things over. But he gets there.
What would you have me do?
Come home, said Renmarie. Sleep on it. You can speak with him in the morning. If you go over now, who knows what'll happen? What'll be said that can't be unsaid? Please.
She held out her hand. Armand looked at it. Then, nodding, he took it.
You're right. It'll keep till morning.
He turned to Annie.
Will you be going to the hotel?
First thing in the morning, yes, said Annie. Once Honoré's awake. Dad,
Yes?
Daniel's a good man. He's not involved in this. You know that, right?
I do.
But he didn't dare look Jean-Guy in the eye. He knew what he'd find there. If anyone else in a homicide investigation had blatantly lied about knowing the victim, they'd move way up the suspect list. And Daniel's actions were suspect, at the very least. Once home, they decided to leave the dishes for the morning and dropped into bed, exhausted. Armand expected to toss and turn, but instead he fell into an immediate and deep sleep and awoke to the sound of rain pelting against the bedroom window. It was dawn on a drizzly Sunday morning. As he closed the window, Armand looked out and into the living room of the apartment across the narrow street. It belonged to a young couple with a child. He didn't know their names, though they sometimes waved to each other. But it was too early for anyone to be up. Except, maybe. He scanned the street below, but saw no one watching their apartment. But then, anyone Securefort trained would make sure not to be seen. Though, oddly, Jean-Guy's man had not only been spotted several times, but made sure he was recognized. No doubt a scare tactic. It seemed, this Sunday morning, that no one was trying to scare him. He looked at the bedside clock, 6:15. As he showered, he thought about Daniel. As he dressed, he thought about Daniel. Then, leaving Reine-Marie fast asleep in the bedroom, he did the dishes as quietly as he could. And thought about Daniel. About what to do, what to say. Putting the coffee on to perk, he went for a walk. Glancing casually about him, he could see no sign of surveillance. It was, he thought, as he put up the umbrella, a bit of an insult. Gamache strolled through the familiar streets of the Marais, the rain, heavy at times, hitting the umbrella. It was, in its familiarity, a restful sound. Pat, pat, pat. He walked past Rue du Temple, pausing, as he always did, to study it. His grandmother had explained that it was named not for a Jewish temple, as he might have imagined, but for the Templars. This was where the Knights Templar had their headquarters, 800 years ago.
"This is where," she told the boy, "they hid the treasure looted from the Holy Land in the Crusades. And when there was the putsch, when the Templars were rounded up and tortured, not one of them revealed where it was hidden."
"The treasure?" young Armand had asked.
"Never found. Apparently still here, on Rue du Temple. Somewhere."
Though by then Armand had understood that the treasure that was really lost were the lives. Armand had gone to bed the night before, hoping, praying, that he'd wake up to find a message from his son, asking him to come around, saying there was something he needed to tell his father. But there was nothing. Well, not nothing. There was an email from Isabel Lacoste saying the engineer she'd consulted couldn't find anything wrong with the Luxembourg plans. And there was one from Mrs. McGillicuddy that he hadn't read yet. Her messages tended to be long and rambling, and he couldn't quite take that, first thing. Gamache realized he'd have to tell Reine-Marie about the contents of Stephen's will. But he wouldn't, he thought, tell Daniel and Annie. Not yet. Armand found himself on the Pont d'Arcole, the bridge that led across the Seine to the Hôpital Hôtel Dieu. Its name, Arcole, was a bit of a mystery, as with so much in Paris. Some said it was named after a great victory by Napoleon over the Austrians at the Battle of the Bridge of Arcole. Some said it was named for a young man killed in the French Revolution. He'd planted the tricolour and shouted, with his dying breath, "Remember, I am called Arcole." Daniel, in particular, had preferred that version, speaking as it did of valour and sacrifice. The sort of heroics that would appeal to the young and untested. But it was, Armand thought, as he continued his walk, an old and dangerous lie. There was nothing right or good in dying for your country. A necessity, sometimes, yes, but always a tragedy, not an aspiration. His anger toward his son had dissipated in the night, and now he thought of Daniel and how frightened he must have been to lie like that. Was he waiting in his apartment for the knock on the door, knowing that, eventually, someone would discover the lie? Someone would come. Armand walked over to the Hôpital Hôtel Dieu and spent half an hour with Stephen, rubbing the cream on his hands and feet, then reading him the world news. The ventilator continued to pump, and the beeping of the machines was steady, almost rhythmic. But the man was still and silent. After a hushed conversation with the nurse and the doctor on duty, Armand kissed Stephen on the forehead, told him he was kind and strong, brave and loved.
"And I know that you always told the truth," he whispered. Then he left.
Though the nurse and doctor stopped short of saying it, he could see in their eyes that soon, very soon, they'd be asking him to make a decision. But he couldn't think about that. Not yet. The boulangerie on his way home was open, and he picked up half a dozen fresh croissants. By the time he got back, Reine-Marie was up.
5, she said, after looking into the bag.
1 must have fallen out.
Of course it did, Chief Inspector. Did you sleep? She asked, brushing crumbs off his coat.
Very well.
How are you feeling about Daniel?
Calmer. You were right to have me wait. I'll go around after breakfast.
He took a long sip of rich, strong coffee, while Reine-Marie spread strawberry jam on her croissant.
I spoke with Mrs. McGillicuddy yesterday about Stephen's will, he said. He made a new one 1 year ago. After some sizable bequests, to his foundation and 1 to Mrs. McGillicuddy, Armand hesitated for a moment before going on. He left the rest to us.
Reine-Marie lowered her croissant to her plate, staring at him. To say it was a shock would have been disingenuous. But still, if she'd thought about it at all, she'd have said Stephen would leave Annie and Daniel's small bequests, and them nothing at all. And certainly not the whole thing. His estate would be split equally among Annie, Daniel, and you and me. Before she could ask, or fight the temptation to ask, he volunteered the information.
According to Mrs. McGillicuddy, after taxes and fees, it will come to several hundred million each.
Reine-Marie's mouth opened slightly, and her lips went pale. Armand wondered if she was about to pass out.
Armand, she whispered. We can't.
He nodded. That had been exactly his feeling, too. But there was a solution to that.
If you want, when the time comes, we can start a foundation. Annie and Daniel can decide if they want to contribute.
Yes, yes, said Reine-Marie. Oh, I know, a home for wayward cats and financiers.
Armand laughed. It felt good. Then he called Daniel, who answered on the 4th ring. Yes, they were home, and he could go over. Armand could hear the chill in Daniel's voice. He knows, thought Armand. Or suspects.
Do you want me to come with you? Asked Reine-Marie.
No, better if I do this myself.
Are you sure?
She searched his eyes.
You're prepared for whatever Daniel will say? You won't...
Make it worse? I'll try not to.
It was a pretty low bar, but still, Armand wasn't completely confident he could get over it.
What'll you do?
It's Sunday. The Archive Nationale will be closed, which is a perfect time to go. I've already contacted the head archivist. She'll meet me there at 10. Are you going to tell Daniel about the will?
No, nor Annie. Not while Stephen's alive.
She tied a scarf at his neck and kissed him, and sent him back into the rainy day, and didn't say what he already knew. It would not be long.
Chapter 27 Armand spent some time on the floor playing with his granddaughters, who were still in their Canadian pyjamas and were insisting on being called Bloom and Dawn.
What does Mummy's name mean?
Bloom asked as she climbed on her grandfather's back.
Rosalind means rose, he said.
And Daddy?
Asked Zora. Your daddy's name is Daniel, said their grandfather. It means, the Lord is my judge. That silenced them. Florence was back on the ground, and Zora was now pouring tea for her grandfather.
What about your name?
Asked Florence. Do you know my name? He asked, accepting the imaginary cup poured from the imaginary teapot.
Papa.
Exactly, he said, and putting out his little finger in a gesture that always made them laugh, he sipped his tea.
His name's Armand, said Rosalind.
Armand,
said Zora, looking at him in that disconcerting way she sometimes had. So pensive.
It means, said Rosalind, tapping her phone to find out.
Getting to his feet and brushing off his knees, Armand turned to Daniel. Maybe we can get some fresh air.
In the rain? No, here is fine.
Please, a little walk. Maybe find a cafe. Just us.
Daniel looked at Rosalind, who nodded. Fine. Where do you want to go? He asked, as they headed for the door.
You decide. Anywhere. Except the top of the Eiffel Tower.
That made Daniel laugh, and he relaxed a little. This was something they shared, a fear, a terror of heights. Armand had first discovered his when he was a boy, and Stephen had taken him up to the second level of the tower. Excited, Armand had raced out of the elevator, right to the edge, and, curling his fingers around the wire fence, he looked out across Paris. And almost passed out. His fingers tightened until they were white, and he stiffened, petrified. Stephen came up behind him and was pointing out landmarks. It took Stephen a minute or so to realize what was happening.
Armand?
But there was no answer. The boy stared straight ahead, barely breathing, almost comatose. Stephen knelt, and, prying his fingers loose, he turned his godson so that he faced away from the edge and hugged Armand to his chest, holding him tight, whispering,
I've got you. You're safe. You're safe.
Daniel discovered his own fear of heights while hurtling on a toboggan down the huge ice slide during Carnival in Quebec City with his mother and sister, while Dad waited down below. Where Reine-Marie was laughing and Annie was shrieking with delight, Daniel's wail was completely different. A gut-wrenching sound Armand immediately recognized. When they reached the bottom, Armand swept the terrified boy off the still-moving toboggan and held him in his arms, whispering,
You're safe. You're safe.
And feeling the heaving sobs against his own chest, as though they were one, while Annie and Reine-Marie looked on, baffled.
Feet on the ground it is, said Daniel, as they put on their coats and grabbed umbrellas.
Once outside, Daniel looked this way and that, before deciding.
You know where I'd like to go? Rue de Rosier. Haven't been there in years.
Perfect.
I haven't been for a while either.
Did I tell you?
That you proposed to Mom there?
A few times, yes. You climbed the wall into some private garden and popped the question. Didn't Stephen suggest that place after you said you wanted to propose in front of the gates of hell?
Yes, though I'm not sure he suggested trespassing.
Bet he did. It felt relaxed, for the first time in a long time. Like the Daniel he always knew was there, but hidden behind a wall Armand couldn't scale, though God knew he'd tried. This was the Daniel everyone else met, cheerful, warm, unguarded, happy. Armand wasn't fooled. He was still on the outside, but it was nice, wonderful really, to occasionally be given a glimpse into Daniel's garden, before being banished again. They walked and chatted about the children, about Paris, about home. Armand brought him up to speed on their friends and neighbours in Three Pines. They were silent for a few minutes. The rain had slackened to drizzle and now seemed to have stopped. They lowered their umbrellas just as they reached Rue de Rosier. It was the heart of the historic Jewish quarter of Paris. There was a synagogue, a Hebrew bookstore, delis, and falafel joints, and among the bustle were plaques commemorating the Shoah.
Hey, Dad, look, it's still here. We have to get one.
He spotted the bright blue front of La Droguerie.
Going to the window, Daniel was thrilled to see that Omar was still making his famous crepes. He knew exactly what he wanted, and a few minutes later, father and son resumed their walk. Daniel with a Nutella and banana crepe, and Armand with a beurre sucré.
"I don't know why I haven't brought Roslyn and the girls here," said Daniel, as he took a huge bite of crepe. "I guess I forgot."
This was the closest father and son had been to normalcy in years, but Armand knew that was about to change. But did he really have to shatter this calm? Maybe they could just keep walking and chatting, and leave it at that. Did it really matter what Daniel did or did not know about Alexander Plesner? But yes, it mattered. And Armand knew if he didn't do this, Fontaine would. And it would be worse, much worse, for Daniel. Bells began to ring, calling the faithful to worship. They sounded from every church on every street, filling the air with music, both joyful and haunting. Ordinary and magical.
"There's something I need to ask," Armand began, keeping his voice steady, neutral.
"You knew Alexander Plesner, didn't you?"
Daniel kept walking as though he hadn't heard.
"I'm on your side, Daniel. But you have to tell me."
Now Daniel stopped and turned.
"So that's why you're here. Not because you want to spend time with your son, but to question a suspect."
"Daniel."
"No, no, have it your way. But why even ask? Sounds like you already know."
"What I don't know is why you didn't say anything. You can tell me. I'm your father."
"You're a cop. That's why you're asking, isn't it? Don't try to say you're asking only because you're my father."
"Only your father?" said Armand,
struggling now to keep his own voice calm.
"That's the only thing that matters."
"That's bullshit. It's never mattered.
Not enough. You're a cop first, and a father way far down the list."
The streets were crowded now, with people brushing by and bumping by, and others staring. At the two versions of the same man, 30 years apart, arguing. Armand looked around, putting his half-eaten crepe in a bin. He said,
"Come in here."
They were at the entrance to a garden. The very one he and Reine-Marie had trespassed in when he proposed. It was now open to the public, with one proviso. On the gate hung a sign. En cas de tempête, ce jardin sera fermé. In the event of a storm, this garden will be closed.
Well, thought Armand, hold on to your hats.
Grudgingly, Daniel followed his father, recognizing that there was no avoiding it now. The tidal wave that had been moving toward father and son for decades was upon them. As he stepped forward, Daniel wondered if his father had any idea what was about to happen. Reine-Marie looked at the stacks of dossiers on the long table in the reading room of the Paris archives. The head of the Archive National, Alida Lenoir, put the last stack down, then sat across from her. They were alone in the great room. The sun was barely making its way through the huge high windows. The lamps on their table were the only source of light. In her early 60s, Madame Lenoir was a legend in the world of archives. She was tiny and solidly built. Her wife was the head of the Bibliothèque Nationale. When the two started their relationship 30 years earlier, it was deemed inappropriate. Not because, they were assured, both had uteruses, but because it was a conflict. Though the women knew what was really being said. This was a dangerous alliance of two powerful women, who now held the keys to too many documents, too much information. They wielded too much control, which was code for power. Refusing to end their relationship, they stared down the establishment and won.
"Okay, spill. Why do you want these, and what's the rush?"
Reine-Marie took off her reading glasses and placed them on a manila folder bursting with thick paper. On it, in a careful hand, was written September 1944. She told Madame Lenoir everything. Archivists knew how to not just keep secrets, but keep them safe. And none better than Madame Lenoir, who listened, nodded. Then, digging into the pile, she found a dossier and shoved it toward Renmarie.
"You'll want to see this."
On it, some long-dead hand had doodled a ship, but instead of masts, it had the Cross of Lorraine. Below it was written, "Lutetia." Armand turned and held his hands, palm out, in front of him, asking for and offering calm.
"Why didn't you tell Commander Fontaine that you knew Alexander Plessner?"
His voice was gentle, almost soothing, trying to hold on to and invite civility. He was clinging to the wreckage of his relationship with his son, no longer sure if it could be saved. But there were, now, more important things.
"Because I was shocked that he'd been killed," said Daniel. "Because I needed time to think."
Armand was grateful Jean-Guy wasn't there. He could imagine what he'd say to that, and what he himself would have said had this been any suspect in any murder investigation.
"What did you need to think about?"
Armand's voice remained reasonable, reassuring.
"Forgive me, I'm confused. Is this my father asking, or the chief inspector? That is your rank now, isn't it? It's hard to keep track."
The collapse had begun. Here in this garden that had always held a special place in his heart. Another sanctuary sullied.
"No matter what my job is, I've always been, and always will be, your father."
"First, are you my father before anything else?"
"Yes."
The answer was swift, absolute.
"Were you my father in the meeting yesterday when you humiliated me?"
"I was trying to help, to protect you."
"I'm a grown man. I don't need your help."
"We always need help."
"Maybe, but not yours. If I'm in trouble, it's because of you."
They were alone in the garden, enclosed by old mansions on all sides, and one of the ancient towers of the Wall of Philip Augustus, built during the Crusades. Once formidable, it was now crumbling. Armand took a deep breath. He could see that Daniel was lashing out, and he could see the pain behind the words, even if he had no idea where it came from.
"Why didn't you say something about Monsieur Plessner after you'd had time to think?"
"Because his death has nothing to do with me or his work with us."
"How do you know that?"
"Because I know the work. He and I had only met a few times. We'd barely started."
"What were you working on?"
"Venture capital."
"Oui, but was there a particular project?"
"That's confidential."
Fighting words once again, but Armand chose not to pick up the gauntlet. He hadn't lived to be an old warrior by responding every time someone wanted to fight. Even his son.
"Especially his son."
"I can find out," said Armand. Daniel smiled, satisfied.
"Yes. The father might trust me, but the cop will find out."
"You seem to think the two are separate."
"They aren't.
Any more than they are with you. You're a banker. I expect that extends to looking after your family's finances. You and Roslyn make sure they're safe."
"I'm doing the same thing."
"Yes, I'm a cop, and I'm just trying to make sure you're safe."
"I'm not a child. Stop treating me like one. I can look after myself, and I can provide for my family. So stop trying to protect me, and stop giving me money."
"What do you mean?"
"Like you don't know. You're always slipping me envelopes with money."
"I honestly don't know what you mean. I haven't done that since you were at college."
"Really?
That day on Mount Royal, a few years ago? I was already a banker, already in Paris, making good money. Way more than you ever made.
And what do? You shoved an envelope into my hand like I'm some broke teen working at McDonald's. Do you have any idea how insulting that was?"
"Did you open it?"
"No, I threw it away."
Armand fell silent and glanced at the wet grass at his feet.
"I don't want or need your money,"
Daniel was saying. "I can look after my own family, and I don't need you to keep me safe. Never did.
And this," Daniel raised the half-eaten crepe, "what's this? More patronizing? Treating me like a child?"
What are you talking about?
Far from being angry, Armor was completely confused.
Coming here was your idea, not mine.
But Daniel was beyond rational thought.
I'm not the only one who lied yesterday.
Daniel's voice was raised, almost shouting.
You did too.
Me?
Don't. Just don't. I know the truth. Mom knows the truth. And I at least didn't betray you to the cops, didn't humiliate you. Neither did she.
What do you mean?
You said you weren't in the special forces, because to admit it would be to admit you could have killed Monsieur Plessner.
But you were, weren't you?
No. Never.
Why do you say I was?
Oh, for fuck's sake!
Daniel shouted and threw his crepe at his father. It hit his jacket and fell to the grass, but Armand didn't move.
I heard. That's how I know.
Heard?
You and Mom talking, downstairs. It was Christmas Eve. I was excited about Père Noël, so I crept onto the landing, and I heard.
What?
You told Mom about taking a job with the Special Forces. You told her about the hostage takings, the terrorists, the raids on organized crime, all the terrible things. You said it was dangerous, that the death rate was high, but it was something you had to do.
Armand's eyes widened, and his mouth opened slightly. He remembered that conversation years ago, but that wasn't how it went.
I never accepted the job. The job I agreed to do was to train recruits, that's all, to try to get them as prepared as possible for whatever they'd face. You have to believe me.
Right, like you believe me. I know you're lying. I know what I heard. I saw Mom crying. You made her cry, and every day after that, when you went to work, I knew you weren't coming home. I hated you for that.
Oh my God, Daniel. Is that why you shut me out? Because you thought I was going to be killed?
Because you cared more for others than you did for us. For me. And yes, because you were going to die. And I couldn't. How could I love you? How could I care? When...
The words came out haltingly, as a wail. The same sound he'd made as a boy, hurtling down from too great a height.
How could I...
All these years,
Armand whispered, unable to find his voice, his eyes burning.
All this time.
Who hurt you once, so far beyond repair, that you would greet each overture with curling lip? The lines from Ruth Zardo's poem exploded in his head, in his chest.
Me,
he realized with horror. I did.
I used to have nightmares, said Daniel.
I remember.
And he did. Daniel crying out in his sleep. Armand and Reine-Marie had gone to him, gently waking the boy with hushed assurances. Then the look of horror on Daniel's face when he saw his father. He'd push Armand aside and reach out thin arms for his mother. 2-3 times a week this happened. He never told them what the nightmares were about. Until now.
It was always the same one. There was a knock on the door. I'd run to answer it, and there you were.
Daniel was heaving now, sobbing, barely able to get the words out.
But you were dead.
Armand was pale, his breathing shallow and rapid. He reached out, but Daniel stepped back, away.
Every time I look at you, that's what I see, a dead man. My friends knew their parents would live forever. But I knew that fathers and mothers leave home and never come back. Your parents did, and now you would too.
Oh, no, said Armand.
He'd deliberately not talked about the death of his parents in front of Daniel and Annie, for fear of scarring his own children, not until they were old enough to understand. So how? And then it came to him. That rainy Saturday here in Paris, years, decades ago, they were visiting Stephen's apartment, and the kids were playing hide-and-seek. They'd found a false door in the armoire in Stephen's bedroom and crawled in. And heard.
their father and Stephen talking, about his parents, and about that day. About the knock on the door, about the very worst thing that can happen to a child. Annie must have been too young to understand, but Daniel did. Parents died. Nightmares came true.
You couldn't be a teacher, a plumber, even a normal cop. You had to do the most dangerous thing. I know you never loved us. If you did, you'd have picked us.
But I did. Oh, my God. Oh, God, I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
He moved toward his son. Daniel stepped back and raised the only thing he had, his umbrella.
Don't come closer. Don't you dare try.
I love you. With all my heart, I love you. I am so sorry.
He stepped forward, and Daniel swung, at the last moment leaning away so that the handle of the umbrella swept by his father's face, close enough for Armand to feel the air ripple. Armand hadn't flinched, hadn't closed his eyes, keeping them on his son the whole time, though it was hard to see clearly. Daniel looked like he was underwater. Throwing the umbrella on the ground, Daniel strode away, leaving Armand staring after him. When Daniel was out of sight, Armand raised trembling hands to his face and wept. For all the pain he'd caused. For all those hours, days, years they'd lost. For the happy, safe, contented little boy who died on the stairs that Christmas Eve, waiting for Père Noël.
Chapter 28.
Ah, look, there's a second floor.
Annie was standing in the living room of Stephen's suite at the Jour 5, wide-eyed, marvelling. While the bellhop took their luggage upstairs to the bedroom, she turned serious eyes on Jean-Guy.
We must never leave.
Jean-Guy parted the curtains and was looking outside as Annie gave the young man a tip and closed the door.
Anyone?
She asked. No.
Now,
said Annie, picking up the room service menu.
What'll we have, little man?
I hope you're asking Honoré, said Jean-Guy, and heard her laugh. For all her apparent light-heartedness, he knew Annie was putting on a front. For Honoré. For him. In reality, she was alert, vigilant, and worried. I need to leave for a few hours, he told Annie. Are you and Honoré all right? The flick will stay outside the door.
I wonder what the other guests must think.
They'll think that someone very precious is staying here, said Jean-Guy, kissing her. As he stepped out of the hotel, he looked to his right, then to his left, as though trying to get his bearings. He turned right and strolled, apparently aimlessly, along Avenue Jour 5. Pausing now and then to glance in the shop windows, he continued his walk, turning into a smaller street. And there he stopped. He'd lied to Annie. Loisel had been outside, watching. Renmarie slowly closed the dossier and looked across the table at the chief archivist.
This file is inconclusive. It quotes anonymous sources as saying Stephen Horowitz was possibly a collaborator, that he claimed to have been working with the resistance but might have been turning them over to the Gestapo for interrogation in the Lutetia.
No, not the Gestapo. Common mistake. Many of the documents, even from the time, say Gestapo, but it was actually a division called the Abwehr that occupied the Lutetia,
said Madame Lenoir.
Who were they?
Intelligence, as bad as the Gestapo. Their job was to wipe out the resistance. They'd arrest suspected members, take them to a room in the Lutetia, and torture them until they gave up others. Then kill them and move on. Many, most, died without a word.
Renmarie had to pause and gather herself.
You know a lot about it.
My grandmother was one of those killed, and the Lutetia, to its credit, has been very open about that time in its history. Many employees fled when the Nazis took over.
So they'd have to hire new people.
Oui. Maybe that's where your Monsieur Horowitz comes in. The fact he was German would work in his favour for the Abwehr. but would have raised suspicions among other employees, and understandably so. Some were definitely working with the Resistance, but others were collaborators, and some were just trying to keep their heads down and survive. It was a confusing time.
To say the least, it would be easy to tar someone's reputation, to make a false accusation.
Madame Lenoir grunted agreement.
Many of the executions after the liberation were reprisals, but not for working with the Nazis. Neighbors took it as an excuse to do away with someone they just didn't like, or who they felt had cheated them, or whose property they wanted. Private vendettas. Hundreds were shot or hanged without any trial at all, though serious effort has been made to go back and sort the real from the manufactured. But it's hard. Documents were destroyed. The archives themselves were in a shocking state after the war. They'd been ransacked by the Nazis, who burned anything that contradicted their worldview. We lost countless irreplaceable manuscripts. For instance, their insistence on an Aryan race. We had document after document proving there's no such thing. It was a construct, a myth, created hundreds of years ago and resurrected by the Nazis.
They destroyed anything proving it?
They tried. Fortunately, the people they sent to do it weren't exactly geniuses. Some evidence survived. Though, let's be clear, the Germans weren't the only ones to ransack and rewrite. It served the Allies well to bury, even destroy, much of the evidence. They needed former Nazis in their own programs. How do you think the Americans got to the moon?
Renmarie shook her head. As a librarian and archivist herself, she knew that history wasn't just written by the victors. First, it had to be erased and rewritten, replacing troublesome truth with self-serving myth.
If Stephen was working for the Resistance, she said, wouldn't he pretend to be a friend of the Abwehr officers? Wouldn't that be the best way to get the information he needed?
Yes, and that became the problem, identifying those pretending and those who really were helping the Nazis.
Renmarie sorted through the small pile of photos in front of her until she came to the one of Himmler, repulsive, toad-like at the table. And behind him, an impossibly young and impish Stephen in a waiter's uniform, beaming. Putting her hand to her face, she stared at it, thinking. She knew Stephen wasn't a collaborator. The question was how to prove it. They couldn't let the smear mar a courageous man's legacy. And they sure couldn't let a lie undermine whatever truth Stephen and Alexander Plessner had discovered. But there was another question that came to mind as she stared at the photos.
The police investigating the murder of Monsieur Plessner had copies of some of these documents within hours of his death. Is that possible?
No.
The answer was unequivocal.
Why not? It didn't take you long to find them.
I'm the chief archivist. I was practically born in a file drawer. I know this place, these files, better than I know my own family.
But Alida, you can't know all the documents in the archives, even just the ones on the wall. There must be hundreds of thousands.
Which is why I know there's no way anyone could have put their hands on that.
She pointed at the file in front of Renmarie, with the doodle of the ship in peril.
So quickly. It would take weeks, months, to dig through all the documents. I think they found what they needed, then left them here to be used when needed.
Which means?
Someone must have been planning this for a while.
Not just someone, thought Renmarie. The file was in the possession of the police. She felt physically sick. Her head was spinning with the effort of trying to grab hold of something too immense to grasp.
When was this file last requested?
She asked. Madame Lenoir got back on the electronic catalogue. It didn't take long before she looked up, meeting Renmarie's eyes.
5 weeks ago.
Does it say by whom?
Madame Lenoir was no longer able to make eye contact.
Daniel Gamache.
Armand stood outside Daniel's apartment and stared at the door. Then he knocked. It was opened by Roslyn, who stepped outside into the corridor and closed the door behind her.
I'm sorry, Armand. He doesn't want to speak with you.
What happened?
I've never seen him so upset.
He'll have to be the one to tell you. But please, Roz,